Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We just spent the whole last 7 or 8 weeks of practice period with the Chinese Zen ancestors, and I don't know if I ever thanked them for bringing green tea to Japan and from there to us. What would we do without it? What would I do without it? So, bowing to the ancestors. Practice period is over. But, of course, we can never exhaust the topics that we choose each year for our theme. And as we've spent these weeks looking, sort of time-traveling back to the early days in China of Zen practice, you may have wondered, what about the women? Did anybody wonder that? Today and then this Wednesday night will be bonus talks to catch up and give the women their place. That's the question I first asked. What about the women? When I first went to San Francisco Zen Center and chanted the list of the male ancestors and noticed there were no women. And we know now, of course, that that list was not necessarily historically accurate, that it was constructed to give legitimacy to create this lineage. And lineage being very important in Chinese culture. And so in more recent years, some scholars and Zen teachers collaborated on creating a list of women ancestors to fill in the gaps. And it's not necessarily historically chronological. Well, it's chronological, but they weren't direct transmission from this woman to this to this to this. They're names that are known through some of them through recent research, for all the way from the earliest Indian women who practiced the Buddha's foster mother who raised him, Mahapajapati, who first lobbied for women to be able to ordain and join the Buddha's Sangha everywhere through India, China, Japan, and the West. So we now have that list, which is chanted in the larger centers, along with the list of male ancestors. And also those of you who have done or will formally receive the precepts receive a document, two documents, with the traditional male ancestors and the women ancestors as well. But I wondered, you know, weren't women practicing then in those early days? And what did they have to say? What did they have to teach us? So today I'd like to kind of time travel once again with you and see what we can find out about the early women of Chan or Zen. We do know through research that there were women practicing from the very early beginnings of Buddhism in China when it came along the Silk Road, the trade route into, from India into China at the very beginning of the Common Era, before Zen arrived. There were convents for nuns, first established in the 4th century, and a key figure from that time was a nun named Jingjian, who is considered to be the first ordained Buddhist nun in China. But in those days, there had to be, women had to be ordained by, with 10 male monks and 10 nuns present to be fully ordained. Plus they had to have permission from a male relative, a father or a brother. So there were, it was mostly educated women from the educated privileged class who were able to do this. And the very first one that I just mentioned realized once the monastic code, the Vinaya, was translated into Chinese, she realized that she wouldn't be able to fully ordain, but she convinced a monk, a priest, to a monk who was visiting from Kashmir, apparently, to give her the basic first 10 precepts. So it's what we now think of as a lay ordination. And they're very similar to the ones that we still use, along with 20 other women, and they set up a place of practice together. So it would be as though 20 women, here, there are very few, imagine there were very few Zen centers, and they were all male, and 20 women decided, we want to do this too, and convinced a priest to give them basic ordination, and set up a practice place together. You know, so imagine that back in the 4th century. And then about 100 years later, some nuns actually came from Sri Lanka along with some monks, and they ordained about 300 women fully, because then they could give them the full ordination, and reordained some who had had partial ordination prior to that. These early convents became refuges for women, not only those who, for various reasons, had no family support, couldn't marry, perhaps, or had lost support, but for those who wanted to take up spiritual practice, and for those who wanted an education, you know, who wanted to study the texts. Fortunately, a record was compiled by a monk named Baojiang around 516 called Lives of the Nuns, and he tells the stories of these really early nuns. But none of their own writings survived except a single poem. And this is in a book of poetry of the Chinese nuns called Daughters of Emptiness. Beata Grant is one of the scholars who's done, you know, tremendous work in this area. And the very first one in her book is from a 5th century nun named Hui Xu. And it goes like this. Worldly people who do not understand me call me by my worldly name, Old Zhou. So that was her family name. You invite me to a 7-day religious feast, but the feast of Zen knows no end. It's translated as feast of meditation, but that's what Zen and Chan mean, meditation. Yeah. So most of these early convents were urban. They were in the larger centers. And as I said, were mostly accessible to women of the privileged class. And as a result, during times of social turmoil, which we, you know, in these recent weeks we've learned were came in waves, you know, with dynastic change. There would be these periods of great disorder and social unrest and conflict and suffering, you know, starvation and disease as well. So during those times, when the Confucian and or Taoist establishment felt that Buddhism was getting too strong, it was a threat, they would destroy monasteries, they would forcibly return the monks and nuns to lay life, you know, and they would have to surrender their robes. So the nuns suffered more from these times of turbulence probably than the monks, because the monks had more freedom of mobility, and they could, as the early Zen monks did practice up in the mountains where they could be more independent. So we have really few records of the women practitioners in these early centuries. Even into the Tang Dynasty, which we covered, you know, during the practice period, there just weren't many records. And you may remember even the teachings of the male masters of those days were transmitted orally, passed down, and often not even recorded until several hundred years after the events happened, or were written down by their students later. And these became, you know, the dialogues and encounters that we know of as koans and the koan collections. So relatively few of them concern women and their experience with their teachers and Zen practice. And ever since I first encountered the koan literature, I thought, what ones have been left out? You know, because men made the selections, right? There are definitely some stories about women who practiced with the great male Zen masters of the Tang and Song dynasties, and I'm going to share some of those stories with you today. But keeping in mind that there may have been many that we just will never know. And many of those stories, the women are anonymous. They're often feisty old women, you know, like selling tea by the roadside and knocking any grandiose monks off their pedestals. And I'm going to talk about the anonymous ones on Wednesday. So today I'm going to tell you about some whose names we know. The very first Zen woman ancestor would have to be the nun Dzongchir, who, according to legend, was one of Bodhidharma's four senior students. And when it came time that he decided he would return to India, leave China. So Bodhidharma, for those who are new, was the monk who, according to legend, brought this emphasis on meditation, Chan, Zen, from India to China. And so he asked his four senior students to come forward and express their understanding, because he was, according to legend, would pick one to be his successor. So Daofu said, they each kind of recited or composed a verse on the spot. Daofu said, "The path transcends language and words, and yet is not separated from language and words." And Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my skin." And then the nun, Dzongchir, said, "It is like the joy of seeing Akshobha Buddha's paradise just once and not again." And he said, "You have attained my flesh." Daoyu said, "The four elements are originally empty and the five aggregates are non-existent. I see nothing to be attained." Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my bone." And finally, Hui Ke came up and simply bowed and stood in silence. And Bodhidharma said, "You have attained my marrow." So I'm not going to go into the details of what they said, but the conventional way this story has been understood is that Hui Ke became, you know, in his silence, became the single Dharma heir, and that the other's understanding was more shallow. So it's often been used to justify seeing women's understanding as more shallow. But Dogen, the Japanese monk who went to China and brought our particular branch of Zen to Japan, has a wonderful commentary on this story. He takes the unconventional view, as he so often does, and says that these answers are not meant to be hierarchical. And in fact, research seems to reveal that all four of these individuals were given Dharma transmission from Bodhidharma. Who knows? But Dogen says each part of the body understands. He talks about, in that way where he talks about our practice being a practice of body and mind, and body and mind not being separate from world. And so he just, in his wonderful way, turns this upside down and inside out and said, they all got it. There are few records of women practicing with the early Zen masters until, in those first, you know, 6, 7, 8 generations, until we come to Guishan in the 9th century, who had a student named Liu Tiemo, and her nickname was Iron Grindstone Liu. She was a tough cookie who could engage in Dharma combat with the best of the monks and grind them up with her sharp wits. That was her reputation, rather iron grindstone. Once she visited Master Zhu Hu, who greeted her and said, Iron Grindstone Yu, I've heard of you. They say you're hard to deal with. Is that so? And she said, I wouldn't presume to say. So he asked her, do you turn left or right? And she just shot back, don't tip over, Master. Then he hit her. That was his M.O. in those days. But also a gesture of deep respect. You know, it was these you know, slaps and hits and things were kind of a code, I think. And it was part of the times. She had a strong peer relationship with her own teacher, Guishan. And you may remember him from the story of his telling his monks that after he died, they would see a water buffalo at the foot of the hill with his name, with Guishan on the side of the on the water buffalo. An unusual pat marking. If they said the water buffalo was Guishan, they would be wrong. If they said it was a water buffalo, they would be wrong. We talked about that story earlier. So Liu Tiemo lived in a hermitage not far from Guishan's monastery. And so that's often what women did. They couldn't practice in the same monastery with the monks, so they'd often have a little hermitage off to the side and go see the teacher. So she went to see him one day, and Guishan said, old cow, so you've come. Now, calling her old cow is not the insult that it would be today. It was actually an endearment. Because you got to remember that water buffalo were honored, you know, beasts in those days. They were very important. And, you know, families would care for their water buffalo. Meticulously. So they're, you know, an important part of village life, agricultural life. The ox. And the ox is often, you know, you think of the ox herding pictures in Zen. So the ox is an important image. So when he says old cow, he's saying it very fondly. And then she replies, tomorrow on Mount Wutai, there's a big gathering and a feast. Are you going, teacher? And Guishan just lay down on the floor and sprawled out. And Liu Tiemo walked out and left. Kind of typical Zen koan story. But to get the flavor of this story, it helps to know that Mount Wutai was 600 miles away. So they both knew perfectly well that they were not going to the feast. Just like the nun, the early nun who wrote that poem, right? We don't need to show up for the big fanfare. We're content right here. I think of Iron Grindstone as one of those women who, like the pioneers in the West of law, medicine, business, who had to be so smart and tough and determined to survive and succeed in a man's world, right? And Tang Dynasty China was definitely a man's world. Yeah. Guishan's successor, Yangshan, must have absorbed something of his own teacher's acceptance of women. He empowered a nun named Miaoxin, which is my Dharma name, Miaoxin. Although I don't, there are two different characters for Miao or Miao. I don't know which one hers is. I want to find out. Mm-hmm. one means wondrous, and the one in my name means bright or shining. Hers was one or the other of those. And she became a teacher, you know, and had students of her own, including 17 monks who one day were out on pilgrimage looking for a teacher, right? And they were going to go see her teacher, Yangshan. But before climbing up the mountain to see him, they stayed at the temple guest house at the foot of the mountain where Miaoxin was the guest master of the guest house. And in their room, they discussed the sixth patriarch's koan. What moves is not the wind, nor the banner, but your mind. Some of you may know that one where the flag, the banner is blowing in the wind. And is it the flag moving, or is it the wind moving, or is it your mind moving? One of the nuns serving at the guest house went back to Miaoxin and told her about these monks arguing over that koan, and she said, "What a shame that these 17 blind donkeys have worn out so many pairs of straw sandals on their pilgrimages without even getting close to the Dharma." So the nun went back to the monks and told them what she had said, and they were very sincere in their search. So they went to see her and bowed respectfully and approached her. And she said, "What moves is not the wind, nor the banner, nor your mind." She might just as well have said, "What moves is the banner and the wind and your mind." Same thing, right? So all, as the story goes, all 17 monks immediately awakened. And they became her disciples and returned home without ever climbing the mountain to meet Yangshan. So the story goes. Another nun who actively taught during the Tang Dynasty was a contemporary of Linji, who founded Rinzai Zen. And a monk was sent by his teacher, Linji, to meet master, the female master, Moshan Liaoran. That's her name. And when he arrived at, and as you you may remember, often Zen masters took the name of the mountain, like Dongshan. Shan means mountain. Dongshan, Yangshan, so they're known as by the name of the mountain, which is also the name of the monastery. So her name was Moshan, and that was also the name of the mountain. So the monk arrived, and he asked her, "What is Moshan?" She replied, "The summit cannot be seen." Then he asks, "Who is the master of Moshan, Mount Moshan?" She replied, "Without the form of man, of a man or a woman." And then he shouted, "Why doesn't she transform herself, like, into a man?" Because it was believed in early Buddhism and probably into these times that a woman could not become enlightened in a woman's body. She had to be reborn into the body of a man first. So if she's such a powerful teacher, why doesn't she transform herself into a man right now? She replied, " I am not a wild fox spirit nor a ghost. What would you have me become? He bowed and took off his hat and became the gardener at her monastery. And stayed for 3 years as her student. And later he would say that, he would say, I got half from Linji and half from Moshan. So he considered her equal to Linji as his teacher. So Dogen knew about these nuns, Miaoxin and Moshan, and told these stories that I just told you in a text called Receiving the Marrow by Bowing. And he said, why are men special? Emptiness is emptiness. Four great elements are four great elements. Five skandhas are five skandhas. Women are just like that. Both men and women attain the way. You should honor attainment of the way. Do not discriminate between men and women. This is the most wondrous principle of the Buddha way. So he was very clear and cited these Chinese ancestors that women would be included in his sangha. He also said, those who are extremely stupid think that women are merely the objects of sexual desire and treat women in this way. The Buddha's children should not be like this. If we discriminate against women because we see them merely as objects of sexual desire, do we also discriminate against all men for the same reason? That's Dogen. There's more to that text that's quite wonderful. But he, you know, he knew about these stories. He didn't know about, at least as far as we know, he didn't know about two later to be very well-respected teachers in their own right, two students of Zen Master Dahui in the 11th century. So they would have been not that long before Dogen's time. Miao Dao and Miao Zong were their names. Miao Dao was once asked by a monk, when words can neither describe reality nor reach the understanding of the hearer, what do you do then? You know, so what do you do with the problem of language, words, the inadequacy of our words to express, fully express the reality of the Dharma, or to be understood by the hearer, right? Sounds like a good question, but we don't know his attitude when we when he asked it. We can speculate that he may have been a bit pompous, perhaps, or trying to trip her up, because this is her reply. Before you have defecated, you have already fallen into the hole. Do not ask too many questions. Even if you are very fluent in debate, and even if you are clever enough to overturn mountains, these skills will do you no good at all in the realm of the Dharma. Originally, before the Buddha appeared, there was nothing whatever to be done. So she brought him down to earth, didn't she? The other Dharma heir of Dahui, Miao Zong, we know more about. She was married to a government official, and so she had quite a bit of mobility because she would travel with him on his official errands, and stopped to hear the teachings of various Zen masters. She must have encountered some resistance, though, to her aspirations to practice as a woman. In an early encounter, she met Master Jinyan, who said, as a well-brought-up lady from a wealthy family, how can you be prepared for the business of a great hero? In other words, taking the heroic path of the Buddha. Is what he said. And she replied, Does the Buddha Dharma distinguish between male and female forms? Her answer suggests that she was familiar with the story of how women came to be included in the Buddha Sangha when his aunt and foster mother, Mahapajapati, asked him three times and he refused. She asked the Buddha three times to be ordained into the Sangha and he refused. Until his attendant, Ananda, asked, are women equally capable of achieving enlightenment? And the Buddha had to admit that yes, they were. And admitted Mahapajapati and apparently several hundred other women who walked barefoot for a very long time to reach the Buddha and petition him. So this story, she would have known this story. And then when Master Jinyan questioned her further, he said, what is the Buddha? This mind is the Buddha. What about you? So he's referring to an earlier exchange in the koan between Zen Master Mazu and his student, Dame. Dame asked, what is Buddha? And Mazu replied, this mind is Buddha. So already this was a classic koan to them. So he's saying, what about you? Miao Zong replied, I have heard of you for a long time. I am disappointed to find that you still say this kind of thing. So my sense was that she wanted him to do more than just give her a cliche of a koan that everybody knew already. She wanted him to see her and meet her fully. Later, she began to attend lectures by Dahui. But as I said, women couldn't stay at couldn't enter the monastery to practice and could come on formal occasions, public talks. But Dahui allowed her to stay in a guest room in the monastery, so this is a little unconventional. And his senior monk, Wanan, did not approve. So Dahui said to him, although she's a woman, she has outstanding merits. Wanhan wasn't convinced. So Dahui urged him to have an interview with Miao Zong. Wanan agreed, reluctantly, and made the request. Miao Zong said, do you want a Dharma interview or a worldly interview? A Dharma interview, of course, he said. So she said, then send your attendants away. So the attendants would have been there as custom because a monk would not be permitted to be alone with a woman. But because this was going to be a Dharma interview, the exception was made. So Miao Zong went into the room first, and a few minutes she called, please come in. When Wanan entered, he saw her lying naked on her back. She pointed at her genitals, saying, what is this place? Oh, sorry. He challenged her, saying, what is this place? Miao Zong replied, all the Buddhas of the three worlds, the six patriarchs, and all the great monks everywhere come out of this place. Wanan said, and may I enter? Miao Zong replied, horses may cross, asses may not. Wanan was unable to reply. Miao Zong declared, I have met you, senior monk. The interview is over. And turned her back. Wanan left ashamed. Later, Dahui said to him, the old dragon has some wisdom, doesn't she? So I've always been a little bit skeptical about this story. You know, as you know, they were passed on orally and embellished. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But there was a pithy exchange that occurred. I also, you know, part of my skepticism is, okay, who made the selection? And, you know, this one was chosen for its shock value and perhaps a little titillation. Nonetheless, her zinger, horses may cross, asses may not, is a play on another earlier koan that would have been well known. A rather arrogant monk asks Zhaozhou, "The stone bridge of Zhaozhou is widely renowned, but coming here I find only a set of stepping stones." So he's saying, "I thought you were such a great guy. I'm not impressed." The bridge being the Zen master who can carry the student across to enlightenment, right? Zhaozhou replied, "You only see the stepping stones and do not see the stone bridge." "What is the stone bridge?" the monk asked. And Zhaozhou replied, "It lets horses cross over. It also lets asses cross over." In other words, the Dharma does not discriminate between the noble and the base. Yeah. So Miaozong knew this perfectly well. And she knew that Wanan also knew it. So she gave it a little twist to show him his discriminating mind, what he was doing. So she continued to study with Dahui and ordained as a nun, probably after she was widowed, because then she finally could, at the age of 67. And she became the abbess of a nunnery and became a teacher in her own right. And there are some records of her talks and also of poems that she wrote as verses in response to a selection of about 60-some koans, which I don't have time to share with you today, but it's quite wonderful that we have some record of her life and teachings. That come down to us here in another era, where sometimes it is still necessary for women of Zen to stand up, sometimes to the very abbot himself, and bring him down to earth, or open up some constricted place in his mind. And there are times still when this needs to happen. We might wish to know more about the teachings and the lives of the early Zen women of China that remain unknown. But we have to be grateful for the work of scholars such as Beata Grant and a few others who have made what records do exist available to us. There was a real kind of revival or flowering of Zen in China in the 17th century, so just pre-modern times. And there's the wonderful poetry and teachings from women from that era that we'll have to wait for another time. But I hope this sampling, and then Wednesday evening we'll do some of the anonymous teachings of anonymous Zen grandmas. But I hope the sampling has been enough to just give you something of the flavor of the courage and imagination it took for these women to practice so long ago. So thank you for listening, and let's chant together.